Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In the last 4 weeks, we've watched in horror and dismay as our government has attempted to contain the damage of the current credit crisis. Despite many bold and controversial moves, the end is not necessarily in sight, nor is there a consensus as to whether and in what ways our financial system may change as a result of this crisis. Joining me to talk about the future of American capitalism, Stephen Moore. He's here in the studio with me. He's a member of the Wall Street Journal's editorial board, former president of the Club for Growth, and author of a brand new book titled The End of Prosperity. Joining us from a studio at WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut, Kevin Phillips, political and economic commentator and former Republican White House strategist. Throughout the hour, we'll take your calls 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, Stephen. Glad you got here.
Good morning.
And good morning to you, Kevin. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Diane.
Kevin Phillips, are we seeing the road toward the end of capitalism?
Well, I'm not inclined to say it's the road toward the end of capitalism. I think it's road toward the end of the supremacy of what I would think of as sort of Dutch, British, American speculative capitalism, which arose back in the 17th century and has really been responsible, if you look at the books about manias, panics, and crashes, for about three quarters of the major problems. And I think that that particular brand, which is so much in the spotlight for failure here and in the last set of sequences over 15 years going back into the 90s, I think we're going to see that type of capitalism yield to an Asian-dominated capitalism, which I suppose you could call state capitalism, maybe Confucian capitalism.
I don't know what that means.
Well, I don't either.
So you're suggesting that there's going to be a change in the basic model that we've been used to for quite some time now, but that it's simply going to be a different kind of capitalism.
Well, I think it's a very different kind of capitalism. It's not to say it's just a minor rebranding. I think it'll be more in the direction of Asia than Western Europe, which means it'll be more in the direction of government's heavier involvement, because Western Europe, although it started out in a more government-oriented way, has moved towards us more in the last 20, 25 years. But I think it's going to be a huge shift. It's not going to be dominated by the United States and by Western Europe.
Stephen Moore, how do you see it?
Well, you know, we wrote this book, The End of Prosperity, because we did see, you know, some really bearish signs in our economy. I think if you look over the one of the points we make is that the last 25 years, from the Reagan era through the Clinton years and even through about 2005 and 6, we had an unbelievable period of prosperity, probably the greatest prosperity in the history of humankind if you look at the increase in wealth and asset values and incomes and jobs. And so to move away from capitalism, which I agree with Kevin, I think there will be an impetus to do that. A lot of people are blaming capitalism for what has gone on here. I worry, my number one worry right now, Diane, is that we will react to this financial panic and meltdown the very same way that Herbert Hoover and Franklin Roosevelt reacted to the Great Depression, raising taxes, trade protectionism, bigger government. And as we learned, everything that the government, every big government intervention in the 1930s actually made the Great Depression much worse and made it last much longer.
But Kevin was talking about the U.S. sort of shifting to an Asian type of capitalism. How does American capitalism differ?
Good question. I think that look, I don't have this great admiration for the Asian model. I remember about 15 years ago, I was on your show, Diane. We were talking about how wonderful the Japanese economic model was. And then Japan went through a 10-year depression. In fact, and a lot of the people who were saying how great Japan was and how that was the model for the future were saying that at the very top of the Japan bubble. So this model of the model that Kevin is talking about is much more kind of statist involvement, direct involvement in industry. I view that as the kind of corporate welfare model, and I'm not so sure it works so well.
Well, the question is, Kevin, do you agree with those who say that this crisis is the end of a 30-year run for the conservative ideas that began with Reagan and Thatcher?
Well, in a sense it is, but I think it's the end of something more, in which you had some very major participation by the other side politically, too. If I were to assign the blame, I would say, in essence, we've had a bubble that's building for the last 25 years. I can get into enormous detail during that time. Total credit market debt in the United States ballooned from about $10 trillion up to something like $47 trillion. You had finance became 20 to 21% of the GDP. Manufacturing plummeted. So it's a combination of all kinds of politics. And the Democrats under Bill Clinton and Bob Rubin as Treasury Secretary were responsible for an awful lot of the growth in bailouts and expansive debtsmanship and what became the Enron mentality and getting rid of Glass-Steagall, which was the old constraint that banks and insurance and brokerage and so forth couldn't all just roll up in one happy bundle and play games. Well, they did roll up in one happy bundle, played enormous games. I think it's about 70% blamable on the Republicans and 30% on the Democrats. It's not strictly conservatism. And when I talk about a kind of Asian conservatism, I think it's less that will practice it, although Bernanke and Paulson are certainly doing their best. I mean, maybe they're going to move to Singapore and start a business. But at this point in time, I think what we'll see is the power passes more to Asia, which will practice that kind of capitalism.
Kevin Phillips, his latest book is titled Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Stephen, how severe do you think this downturn is going to be for the U.S.?
I don't have a clue. I really don't. For the first time in my career, I'm totally flummoxed by this. I think everyone is completely confused. You know, we've seen the government move in with two big, what I call the first was the nuclear bomb, which was the $700 billion bailout package that we passed on Friday. And then another thing a lot of people aren't paying attention to is for the last 2 weeks, Diane, the Federal Reserve Board has just been pumping a Pacific ocean of money into the economy like nothing we've seen before.
So you were in favor of the bailout at first, and now
I'm having some real second thoughts about it. I mean, remember when the first bailout package passed on that fateful Monday, which was about 10, 12 days ago, the market tanked by 700 points. Remember
right.
that? And everybody said, this is because of the failure of this package. But look at what has happened in the 5 days since we passed the package. The market has had arguably the worst week in history. And you've had this flood of money. And so what I'm saying, Diane, is we've used every tool, you know, we've got in the arsenal already. I mean, we haven't cut taxes, which I'd like to see done. But we've had a huge bailout and we've seen a flood of money. In fact, there have only been two periods in the last 20 years when we've seen such a deluge of money by the Federal Reserve. The first was right before the Y2K crisis, when everybody was worried the banking system would collapse because the computers, remember that, the computers were going to break down. Thankfully, that didn't happen. And the other big deluge of money happened after 9/11, when the Fed, I think quite appropriately, wanted to make sure we didn't have a financial package panic and pump money in. But this deluge of money has been larger than ever before. And one last point, Diane. In the last 2 weeks, you know, want to talk about the end of capitalism. We have put the largest investment bank in the world in the Treasury Department. For the next couple of years, the Treasury Department will be a massive investment bank. Now, what Ben Bernanke announced on Tuesday was that the Fed will now be the largest commercial bank. It will now start making direct loans with businesses, bypassing banks.
So what does this do to the nature of capitalism as we have known it?
Well, I think it's a threat to capitalism. This is why even among the conservative movement that I'm a part of, there was a great debate and it got quite heated among those who said this is a crisis and we have to have government intervention, and others, you know, who I respect, who said, you know, my co-author Art Laffer in this book said, no, we should defend capitalism now, not support the biggest. What we saw on Friday was the largest expansion of government power in peacetime, perhaps in American history.
Kevin, you know, as we talk about this, it seems that those who've been hollering, the sky is falling, the sky is falling, are really on the mark. Do you agree?
Well, I think, unfortunately, the sky is in some respects falling. It's falling because nobody understands what the sky really is.
Yeah.
One of the things that you see in all of this is that I'm almost thinking of Bernanke and Paulson as a latter-day reincarnation of Martin and Lewis, to take sort of a clown act of my youth. They're not on top of anything.
Right. I agree, Kevin.
Yeah, it started out back last summer when Paulson was saying, oh, this is, you know, nothing. It's just a little real estate problem. He has no sense of the extent to which Wall Street has taken over what he likes to call the real economy. Unfortunately, if you look at the numbers, finance is the real economy.
All right, we'll take a short break here. When we come back, your questions, comments, stay with us. Welcome back. We're joined now by John Makin. He's an economist and visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Good morning to you, sir. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Diane. Good to be here.
You have said that those steps should have been taken sooner. We are moving in the right direction. Do you still hold to that view?
Well, yeah, I think the steps that the Treasury and the Fed have taken at an accelerating pace over the past 2 weeks are certainly in the right direction. They're useful. I'm afraid that it's hard to escape the conclusion that the momentum in terms of the loss of activity in credit markets and other lending markets has been so great that they're in the awkward position of trying to repair what is already a lot of damage, specifically the commercial paper market, where everybody does their funding in order to finance credit card transactions and many other things that affect households, remains not functional. And the interbank market, where banks lend to one another, is still, in effect, closed. So the channels of credit are clogged. The patient, if we look at the economy and the credit markets as a patient, they're in the emergency room. We keep hitting them with the electric shocks to try to revive the patient, and we haven't succeeded yet, but the patient hasn't expired yet either.
But the question is, which of any of the steps that have been taken thus far do you think suggest a fundamental shift for American capitalism?
Well, certainly the Treasury's step to pass the $700 billion so-called bailout bill is unprecedented, except you have to go all the way back to the Great Depression with the Reconstruction Finance Corporation that was initiated in 1932 and expanded in 1933 in order to see something on that order of magnitude. The Fed's activities directly, in effect, lending to a massive insurance company like AIG over $100 billion, also unprecedented. And the Treasury's measures to lend to investment banks that started back in March with the Bear Stearns failure were also unprecedented and unfortunately unsuccessful since there is no more investment banking industry. So we're doing unprecedented things, things that are comparable to the scale of measures undertaken in the Great Depression, except the Fed is still perhaps not moved to overt printing of money, which was in effect required in the Great Depression. So we have a few bullets left in the gun, but we've taken unprecedented steps, and we are hoping that those will be sufficient. If they're not, it's probably up to the Fed to cut interest rates further and be more aggressive.
Of course, Kevin Phillips suggested earlier that we may be moving toward an Asian form of capitalism. What's your view on that?
Well, Asia is not a homogeneous place. I mean, there's Japanese capitalism, there's Chinese capitalism. So I don't really know what he means by that.
Kevin Phillips, do you want to explain?
Well, I think when I'm talking about Asian capitalism, I'll take it as a broad description of what you get from the Persian Gulf through India and China and Japan and Southeast Asia, in the sense of much more of an activist government, and now it's increasingly sovereign wealth funds as an adjunct of government, type of capitalism. The Chinese have a huge history of very strong commercial capacity. China is not only China, it has the overseas Chinese, which were a huge factor in the Philippines and Indonesia and Singapore and Malaysia and Thailand and so forth. So I think that the Asian definition is broad enough that we have to look at that. Now, I think what's going to happen in the United States in the next 4 or 5 years is that we get elements of super interventionist capitalism in the way that Japan did it, and probably no great better result. But we're going to have, as has been pointed out, the money that's being created now, in a sense, or the balances or what have you, hasn't been sterilized. Inflation is coming. You're going to have an inflationary decade. In 2000, you had the Dow at about 11,700. In the year 2010, we may have it down at 9,500. And you'll have to add in all the inflation as a further discount to the real value of it.
All right, I know.
Headed for a mess.
I know John Macon is going to have to leave soon, so I want to give him
a comment on that. You know, the model in Japan is probably a good one to compare. The Japanese had a property bubble that burst. They were slow to respond. Ultimately, they ended up printing money and pushing their debt to GDP ratio to 120% of GDP. Ours is now 40. And in the face of all that, they had deflation. And the reason is that in a crisis like this, you don't worry about inflation, you worry about deflation. The source of the deflation is a massive increase in the demand for cash that needs to be satisfied by the central bank. So I would agree that we may move toward more government intervention, I would strongly disagree, Kevin, that we're going to see inflation. The problem is going to be deflation.
John Macon, one last.
The Japanese case is pretty consistent with that.
One last question for you. How equipped do you think our political leaders are to deal with the economic crisis we're now facing?
The record so far is not encouraging. I would characterize their actions as piecemeal and reactive, and we're accumulating a lot of unintended consequences. That said, I would say that both the Fed and the Treasury are on a rapid learning curve, and there's nothing like the need to survive to focus people's attention. So I think we've turned the corner in terms of this is a serious fight to the death battle with a credit crisis and a financial panic, and I think we'll see more concerted efforts from the Treasury and the Fed going forward.
John Macon, economist and visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, my pleasure.
Thank you. And now to Bill Greider. He's national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of The Soul of Capitalism. He has a new book coming out next year titled Come Home, America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. Bill Greider, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Diane.
You've said that this crisis changes everything. What do you mean?
I think it's one of those breaks in history where all of the governing assumptions that have run the country and run our lives for at least 25, 30 years are in disarray and even collapsing in many ways. That's about the financial crisis, most obviously. But we were already at the end of the what we call the conservative era of market fundamentalism, both in politics and in popular reactions to. I mean, Americans have been saying for several years, overwhelmingly, like 80%, we're on the wrong track. Now it's very clear the wrong track we have been on. What I see happening now, I used somewhat playfully the phrase born again democracy. An opportunity, an opening for people to step up and reengage for themselves and their own communities, not for the Democratic Party or the Republican Party or any of the other governing elites. They are all in disarray and in some ways disgrace, but to really rethink everything. And by that I mean take the old order, which is centered in the financial system, and Kevin has written about it, and so have I for many years, is crumbling. Both political parties, for many years, have been aligned with that order, and in the obvious ways of campaign contributions, but basically they accepted the doctrine. Now the old order is struggling quite visibly, aware of its vulnerability, to hang on to power. And up to now, both political parties, Democrats included, have sided with the old order in that struggle.
Bill, tell me what changes you would hope to see with respect, for example, to the banking industry.
Well, I think you begin again to imagine a banking system that allocates credit and capital to the American economy to actually not just be re-regulated, but reordered to serve the country rather than to serve itself. Now, that sounds crude, but that's the essence of it. Kevin has described that in great detail, and I have too. And we're seeing now the results of that in these inflated values, which were never real in any sense of real productive economy, but were always, as Kevin calls it, speculative. I would call it more delusional. That's the best I can say for them. I mean, a lot of people in the Wall Street and in banking and in business believed in those values. Some of them still do.
Stephen Moore, are you one who still believes in those values?
I'm not sure exactly what values we're talking about, but I shudder when I hear Bill talk about, you know, repudiating the policies of the last 30 years because they've created the greatest period of prosperity for Americans.
I've got to interrupt there.
I mean, let me just make one point, Bill. The value of U.S. assets in U.S. households in 1980 was $17 trillion. Last year, it was $58 trillion. No country in the history of civilization has seen that kind of buildup in wealth and worth and jobs. We created 48 million jobs over the last 30 years. That ain't so bad.
Well, let me. I don't want to argue with Stephen Moore. We've collided before, and it's a fruitless discussion because he has an orthodoxy to sell, and it's interesting that he's still selling it hard even as it's collapsing.
He's confused, Bill.
But I have to let me stop on his assertion, which right wingers have made endlessly over the last 25 years, that this is the best of all possible times. That is not true.
I'm saying what we had. It's not now, but it was.
I don't argue with him. Yeah. You know, he has a skill on television and radio. I've encountered it before.
Thank you.
Just as you're laying out the case, he interrupts with that claim.
Well,
and
disparages now.
And Diane, this is.
I'm not disparaging you. I'm just.
let me just say, Bill Grider, that Kevin and Stephen started out this program. Stephen said right at the outset, I am confused. I'm not sure what I believe anymore. I think there is an acknowledgement of some, at least wavering on some of the long-held beliefs. At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Kevin, you wanted to come in.
Yes, just quickly, I think there's one thing you can do that bridges what Bill is saying and what Stephen Moore is saying. You've had this huge growth of prosperity. It's hard to know exactly what it was because it was backed up by an almost parallel growth in debt, extraordinary, huge amounts of debt. And now the debt is beginning to implode and tumble in a way that jeopardizes a lot of those statistics and may sort of sweep it all back towards a much more uncomfortable position. And the last thing I think should be pointed out very quickly is a huge difference between this period and the end of the 20s and beginning of the 30s. When that crash came, you were in a global deflation based on crumbling commodity prices. You may have a little flicker here now, but the whole pattern of the last decade has been hugely up in commodity prices. And if you throw in the huge amount of money that's being created right now, and I agree with Stephen Moore on that, inflation is likely to be the distinction that kills them.
Can I jump in,
sure.
Diane?
Go ahead, Bill.
Here's my distinction from what Kevin has just said. And I have more than once in the nation spoken of this and described it in more detail, but what we are witnessing now is the deflation of Wall Street. That's different from the overbroad monetary deflation, the falling prices that Kevin is talking about. We're seeing the bubble of speculative wealth and profit, et cetera, that was created generated by supply-side economics, blah, 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 over the last 20, 30 years, losing air, and it's doing it rather rapidly, and that's a phenomena separate from the danger, which is still present. Although I agree with Kevin, I think it's not probably going to happen, a full monetary deflation like the one that followed 1929. This is important to understand. And when I say the old order is collapsing, that's the old order I mean. The government, very directly, again, this is not a partisan complaint, collaborated with financial system in developing those, the different laws, mechanisms, stripping away regulation, lots of other things, and above all, monetary policy and the Federal Reserve's dereliction.
All right, I want to give Stephen Moore a chance
just
to comment.
Just one quick point. It shows how, when I said I was confused, I'm not confused about my ideology or how we should get out of this. I'm confused about how long it's going to take us to unwind from this meltdown. But it's interesting, isn't it, Diane, that we have two people. One is saying that our threat is deflation, and I'm saying the threat is inflation. So we can't even agree on what the threat is to the economy. My feeling is that what we're headed into, and this is my fear, is a 1970s style stagflation. In the 70s, that's why I get confused when people say the last 30 years have been terrible. No, the second worst decade in the twentieth century was the 1970s with Nixon and Ford and Carter. And what they did is they pursued a very loose monetary policy, and we had increases in inflation and we had increases in unemployment. And I fear that we're headed right back to those. So I'd love to see deflation. I'm much more worried about rising prices.
Are you also, Stephen, more worried about the rise in unemployment?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you're going to see, we are in a recession right now. There is no question, Diane, and
Are we headed for a depression?
No, I do not believe we are. And a depression is basically just a long, long recession.
And
I mean,
you don't
believe
this.
I don't think so. I really don't. And right now, our unemployment rate is 6 to 6.5%. In the Great Depression, Diane, the unemployment rate hit 25%. Let's hope we're not headed to a depression.
Stephen Moore, member of the Wall Street Journal's editorial board, Kevin Phillips, and he has written many, many books. I'll give you a title later. Bill Greider, his book, The Soul of Capitalism. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by WAMU's The Conversation, with listener-generated discussions and a monthly online chat with Diane Rehm. More information at conversation.wamu.org. And by the Pew Charitable Trusts, examining the paths to opportunity in a new report from its Economic Mobility Project at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Some feminists are baffled by how a conservative like Sarah Palin can become a symbol of women's empowerment. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the conservative women's movement with Ronnie Schreiber, author of Writing Feminism, Conservative Women and American Politics. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Before we open the phones, I want to say a big thanks to William Greider, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation. His book, soon to be published, is titled Come Home, America. All right, let's go now to Toledo, Ohio. Good morning, Jason. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you for having me on the air.
Certainly.
I've had this concept of written down since 2001, and it's basically this: that capitalism at this point in our history is based solely on the bottom line and profits, and basically based on insatiable greed. Once capitalism gets equally joined with not only concerned with the bottom line profits, but also concerned with how it affects people sociologically. The effects on workers and their families and communities, and then also the third pillar being ecologically sustainable. If capitalism was based not just on profits, but also on a responsibly socially responsibility socially and also ecologically responsible.
Okay, thanks for calling, Jason. What do you think, Kevin?
Well, I think it's going to be very difficult to handle all of these problems at the same time as you try to redefine something. Capitalism is not responsible, really, for the environmental problems. You can do all sorts of carbon footprint tracking, I suppose, but trying to square away employment, environmental preoccupation, making capitalism nice, 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 and repackaging things as they're kind of imploding is going to be an enormous difficulty here. And the sidebar I want to emphasize is that during the 1970s, which I agree with Stephen Moore, there's more relevance here than a lot of the quote-unquote mainstream people think, what you would see would be recessions, right, which would be very tough on assets. Right. And then you'd see an inflation bounce back as soon as the recession was over.
Yep.
And you had assets deflation and popular and generalized inflation, and they can go together.
All right. Here's an email from Jack, who says, and this sort of picks up on Jason's point, says, imagine seven poker players. Over time, through luck and skill, one of the players acquires all of the chips at the table. The game is over unless the players can agree on a scheme to redistribute some of the chips. That is what has happened in the world economy. 1% of the population owns everything, and the game is over, including the loyalty of our politicians. If you would have guests on other than professional economists, we might be able to hear a discussion of what's really happening. How do you like that analogy, Stephen?
Well, look, I think the top 1% are doing too well the last few months. I mean, they've had massive reductions in wealth. The billionaires have lost billions. And this is going to – people may not believe in trickle-down economics, but we are going to see this, you know, trickle-down, and it's going to hurt everyone. Everyone's assets are falling, as Kevin said. We are going to see increased unemployment. But to this point about capitalism, capitalism is by far, historically, the most moral system. If you look at what's happened over the last 15 years, we've seen a dramatic decline in poverty all over the world in countries like China and India because of capitalism. And they moved away from socialism, which kept their people desperately poor. And now they have increased living standards.
Give me a two-sentence definition of capitalism.
Allowing the free exchange of goods and services with minimal government intervention.
Do you want to add to that, Kevin?
Well, I would say that capitalism comes into play when the state isn't dominating everything and there's attention to the fact that people are greedy, people have hunger for their own property, and to think you can do that through straight socialism is foolish. But capitalism, just unfettered, is essentially unworkable, and we keep finding that out periodically in history.
To Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Love the show.
Thanks.
Unlike a lot of the people on your show right now, I don't get paid to believe any one dogma. I'm out here a retiree living in America. And right now I am furious because back when Reagan was president and we deregulated the savings and loan, people walked away with sackfuls of money and the public picked up the bill for the deregulation. Now we've come full circle. The administration has been beating the deregulation drum, and here we are, the people that caused this walking away with sackfuls of money and the public being left with a bill. So my question is, if and when we ever get over this current crisis, what is to prevent it from happening again if we don't regulate some of this to keep it on the up and up? You know, a famous man once said that free enterprise presupposes morality.
Kevin.
Well, has the caller ever heard the joke about why the Interstate 95 in the East is the world's largest drain pipe? The answer is it connects two sewers, Washington and New York. I don't think there's any solution. I think we've got a corrupt politics and a corrupt finance, and we're going to go through a ringer. That's going to produce some reforms. I wouldn't bet it produces all the right ones. Countries that are leading world economic powers that go downhill do not go downhill gracefully.
Do you think we are in for a new period of stronger, tougher regulation? And if so, is it going to do any good, Kevin?
Well, yes, I think we're in for that. The pattern historically is that countries react in different ways. I think that what you may see in the United States is that the one way the average American and the people, the bottom two-thirds of the country economically, can basically get even is to get their full Social Security, get their pensions, get their medical assistance, and basically say, okay, you people who've had a field day for the last 25 years, you can pay for it. So I think we're going to see government in new ways. Some people won't like some of the ways. And regulation is not the only thing. I think that dealing with entitlements by taking things away from the ordinary American is going to be a very, very rough thing to do in the next 5 years.
Stephen.
Well, deregulation was a big, I think, savior of capitalism in the late 1970s, early 80s. We deregulated the transportation and airline industry, which was a huge boom to consumers. We deregulated financial services. That's where 401k plans came from. We created IRAs, all sorts of new financial instruments so Americans could become involved in the financial markets and share some of the benefits of the huge prosperity we had in the 80s and 90s. And now the question I'd ask is, what regulations do you want to see of these
financial
markets?
But now, wait
markets?
A minute, Stephen. I want to take you on a little bit here. We deregulated the airline industry, presumably to create more competition. What has happened now? You've seen airline after airline go bankrupt. You've seen prices for airfares skyrocket as gasoline prices have gone up. You know,
Diane, we did that. We deregulated the airlines 25 years ago.
I understand.
And over the last 25 years, we've seen a massive reduction in airfares. I mean, if you go on, if in the last few years, you go on an airline, it's families, it's low income. People can afford to fly. It used to be only rich people could afford to fly. I mean, airline deregulation is one of the great triumphs. This is not people like me at you know, Wall Street Journal, Cato Institute, Brookings Institute, almost every economist who's looked at this has said it's been a huge triumph.
And
same thing
now,
with even the financial.
And now?
Well, because what's going on right now, the airlines are going bankrupt because you've got these huge fuel prices right now, and it's become extremely, you know, the airlines are hugely energy dependent, and they're having a hard time paying their bills.
Is that the only reason, Kevin?
Well, I think that you've had deregulation show that it's gone too far in a large number of circumstances. Financial gamesmanship is one of them. A second was when they deregulated the energy business so that the merchants, Enron, could play their mathematical games, and now utilities are going back to a more normal pattern. There have been a lot of excesses of deregulation, and that always happens. I agree that some of it was necessary 20 or 25 years ago, but to say it was an unfettered triumph is, I think, quite inaccurate.
Right.
Now, where we go from here is going to be a hell of a struggle in the next couple of years, and it really starts to make sense to talk about what the next administration is going to do and what the two possible approaches are. And, you know, that's nobody really knows what it's going to be on January 20th.
So what do you see as the road ahead, Kevin?
Well, I think it's going to be a very hard time for Americans. I think stage two of the downturn comes as consumers shut their wallets and this feeds through into the Main Street. And we have a serious downturn, and that will then cause some more of the loan structure to implode, and it's going to be a very difficult thing. My guess is that what you're going to see, just as the rise of finance replacing manufacturing has been as serious as manufacturing replacing agriculure 100 years ago. You're going to see some of what is now finance is going to have to become somewhat like a utility. This has been raised by some people in Britain and the States, Henry Kaufman on Wall Street. I think you're going to have to parts of the financial structure that take care of ordinary Americans' money, whether it be deposits or brokerage accounts or retirement accounts, have to be segregated from the cuties, the gamesmen, the experimenters, the hedge funds. And parts of it may well have to be, so Kaufman and others suggest, really made utilities, just as the railroads were made utilities within 30 or 40 years of having been buccaneers.
How do you react to that, Stephen?
Well, it's not such a good deal. I mean, if you look at the course of the stock market over the last 150 years since the New York Stock Exchange opened its doors through recessions, depressions, and so on, I mean, for the long term, I mean, if there's one message people can go with, for the long term, I'm talking about 10, 20, 30-year investments, you want your money to be in stocks. You don't want it to be
Not live that long,
well,
Stephen.
But that's right. So as you get older, you want to move out of stocks as you're, but I'm talking about for young people. You know, if you're investing for 20 or 30 years, you want to be in stocks.
What happens to the accounts of people who've already retired?
Well, but what people should do when they're moving into retirement and they need to spend down their money, they should move out of stocks into safer investments. So people who need to spend that money out of their savings.
But right now, those accounts are declining.
You're exactly right. But let me just say this. We have been through this before. I want to talk people down from the ledge so they don't jump off. I mean, we had a major financial crisis in 1981, 82 when the Dow Jones hit 800. We got out of that. We had the savings and loan crisis. We got out of that. Remember the October 1987 stock market crash when stocks fell by 15%, we got out of that. And then we had the technology bubble bursting in 2000. All of those things. So, folks, it's not a depression.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Kevin Phillips, we're getting lots of angry emails about we are not speaking up for average people. And what Stephen has just said may work for some, but what about the average person as this kind of shift in the economy goes on? What's going to be there to protect the average person from jumping?
Well, first of all, they shouldn't jump. Obviously, if you've got a problem, don't jump. Get angry. Get angry at the politicians. Get angry at Wall Street. Get angry at the worthless media that never cover anything with any intelligence, unlike your show.
Thank you very much.
But this drivel that comes in most of the papers and network program. Get mad, people out there. Really get mad. Maybe march on your state capitol. March on Washington. Stick a giant Roto-Rooter right in the Potomac, you know, and push. These people, the people who did this bailout and the people who structured it to try to make themselves economic Hitlers, you really can do better, Americans. Concentrate on it.
Here is an email from Adam who says, when I heard Dick Fuld was attacked at his gym after his testimony to Congress, remind us of who he is.
He's the head of, was it Lehman Brothers? One of the big investment houses, yeah.
Head of what used to be Lehman
Brothers. Exactly.
Adam goes on to say, I felt more than a bit of schadenfreude. When do these masters of the universe get their comeuppance?
Well, the one thing I really disagree with, I mean, in terms of what these guys did, you know, I never had a problem with people taking big salaries, $20, $30 million, if their company was performing. What I really disagree with, and this is something that is not in the interest of the taxpayer or the shareholder, is these golden parachutes of people jumping out of these companies as the building is burning down. And I think that's something that makes people really angry. And, me too.
And this is where I think the ordinary individual looking at this whole thing would say, and I wonder about your opinion, Kevin, does anybody deserve $20 to $30 million?
Some got 10 times more than that.
In a single year when there are people on the street and families who cannot afford to put food on the table. Something is wrong with a system that allows this.
Well, back in the days when finance didn't ask for a bailout, J.P. Morgan, who was fairly well known, said that the people that run the businesses shouldn't get more than 20 times the salary of the ordinary person who worked in those businesses. I don't know whether you should have government make a cap, but I think you really have to get people furious because the rise in the concentrations of wealth have really gone hand in hand with the rise of debt and of a finance that sort of fattens on little charges here and there.
They've gone bonkers, and
that's right.
I think I'll lead the road to anger and outrage and hope that people will follow. Kevin Phillips, his latest book is titled Bad Money: Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. Stephen Moore, his new book is titled The End of Prosperity: How Higher Taxes Will Doom the Economy If We Let It Happen. Thank you both.
Thank you,
so
Diane.
Much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.